All right. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing all right. I'm here in Florida, and I'm talking to you on a little netbook. So the picture is very blurry, and I'm also having to use my iPod or my iPhone headphones. So this is the kind of low tech version of blogging heads for me today.
I have my first ever camera mounted on the top of my computer, so I feel like one of those Olympic announcers. You know, they love those shots where the two guys would be standing there and talking to the cameras above them.
Yeah, yeah. I think, well, you wanted to talk about the Olympics, right? What did you want to talk about regarding the Olympics?
Well,
we have to introduce ourselves.
I love I'm Rich Lowry, National Review.
And I am Anna Marie Cox, and I am now employed, unlike the last time we talked. I am the Washington correspondent for Gentleman's Quarterly, which actually comes out monthly, for those of you who care about such things.
Congratulations.
But anyway, the Olympics.
Yeah, I'm a big Winter Olympics guy. I just love anything on ice or snow. So just anything I could turn on at any time and pretty much be transfixed, with the exception of the men's figure skating. And I also didn't become part of the curling craze, perhaps because it seemed to air in the afternoons when I wasn't watching.
You know, it's funny. I was one of the people that really got into curling, in part because, as I've mentioned, my father lives in Canada, where curling is a real thing. And he was really avidly following it. And also, I happened to be at a bar when they were playing the U.S. women's versus, I think, the Danish women. And it was pretty, like, nail-biting. It's actually, like, it moves really – just because something moves really slow doesn't mean that it can't have a lot of tension, right? French thrillers are like that, as well as – and I know I'm going to preview our next topic, which is healthcare reform.
Yeah, I had some friends who were actually going out to New Jersey last weekend to do some curling. So maybe it's one of those things that you have to do really to get into it. But my main event was the hockey. I have behind my shoulder here my vintage USA 1980 hockey jersey, the most transcendent sporting event of all time as far as I'm concerned. So I was disappointed the guys didn't pull it out this time, but it's not quite the same with the NHL players because it has a little bit of a feel of just a grand all-star tournament.
Yeah, that's sort of the way, obviously, that basketball is, too, these days. And I am a fan of professional basketball, but I wish that they wouldn't play in the Olympics, which actually brings me to sort of maybe this is where our political differences may come to the front, which is that I think the Olympics are kind of a bad thing. I mean, their corporate sponsorships are just, you know, way over the top. They're not fair anymore. I mean, the definition of professional athlete has just slipped and, you know, slid around so much that basically anyone can compete. And also the IOC has been corrupt for decades.
Oh, yeah, the whole thing's a wreck.
And it really hurts me to, like, support that institution. But then again, every time Olympics are on, winter or summer, I can't help but, you know, that national pride or whatever. You know, maybe it's the fact that in some sports in general, just because, you know, national pride.
Yeah, you definitely get that thing going. And I was watching the USA, the final gold medal hockey game at a bar, and you do feel a little bit of those kind of British soccer thug kind of stirrings somewhere in you. And one of the great sports books of all time is Bill Buford, Among the Thugs, about the soccer thugs.
Yeah, I've read it. It's a fantastic book.
Yeah, and his theory was these were economically dispossessed people kind of lashing out at their economic fate. And what he really found, no, they're really mostly middle-class people, and it was kind of these atavistic, warlike urge within them that was coming to the fore rather than any economic forces. So I think any sporting event, you have a little bit of that going on, except for maybe the figure skating. But I don't know, the figure skating, that the Korean woman who won, you know, an entire fate of South Korea, we were told repeatedly, was on her shoulders.
That's right. And also, I mean, figure skating is the only sport that I know of that's widely publicized where we had one Olympic hopeful, you know, induce violence on another Olympic hopeful. So, you know, figure skating, I guess there's a mob mentality there as well. What do you think? Here's a question for you. What did you think about the behavior of the Canadian women's hockey team going out on the ice with their stogies and beer and champagne?
Generally, I'm anti-blatant celebration. I hate it during games. I hate it during NFL games. I wish you could just tackle, you know, get a sack and pretend like you've had a sack before and not make it, you know, a 30-second
do the chicken dance or whatever it is they do.
But I don't know. Whenever women break out cigars, it's always, I find it kind of endearing. So, and I don't know why it was a cause for an investigation.
I mean, I guess it was the use of the rank that was a problem. Although I found myself actually feeling very positively towards the Canadian women's team, even though they beat us. In fact, just because it's cool for on my point, maybe you like seeing women smoke cigars for whatever Freudian reasons you do. But I like to see women being tough, and that is definitely that's what they showed all those teams when they were playing. So I just felt like those were my sisters, and so I wasn't really upset about it. Now do we want to talk about healthcare, where we really are going to have some differences?
Sure. Just one last hockey thought. I love hockey.
Did you play hockey?
I briefly tried to learn how to play hockey. I had to teach myself how to skate, and my skating instructor here in New York was a gold medal winner from a USA team a while ago. And mm-hmm. You want to talk about a tough lady? She was fantastic, and she had never. I think she was from Minnesota, never worn figure skates in her life because she had an older brother who wore hockey skates from the beginning, and she was like, well, if he's wearing hockey skates, I'm going to wear hockey skates too. And that was the beginning of a gold medal winning U.S. women's hockey player.
I had no idea you were such a feminist, Rich. That really does my heart good. Do you want to talk about healthcare?
Let's talk about healthcare.
All right, what do you think?
Well, the big debate now is over reconciliation and whether this is a foul trick that Democrats are pulling, or whether it's a simple act of democracy where the 51 votes actually prevail. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's possible that it's a little of both. It is a legislative maneuver. A maneuver always sounds, it's sort of like when we used to talk about plots and schemes in relationship to Social Security. Maneuver sounds kind of dodgy, but it's something that is part of one's legislative toolbox. Both parties have used it numerous times over the years. And I don't see anything wrong with doing it. I am intrigued by the attempt by Republicans to turn it into some kind of dastardly mechanism, because they've used it so many times in the past, and because it's not being used to pass the whole healthcare bill. We have a Senate version of a bill, and we have a House version, and we're reconciling the differences between them, which are great. That I think you and I both know, we're not going to wind up with anything close to the House version. We're going to wind up with something much closer to the Senate version.
Yeah, well, I would say a couple things. First of all, you have to stipulate up front on any of these sort of process discussions, they're just festivals of partisan hypocrisy. So
yes.
On the Republican side, they can pull out, you know, all these stirring statements from Joe Biden and Chris Dodd and all the rest of them about how the filibuster is necessary to the workings of the Senate as we know it, and then Democrats can pull out the file footage of people like Senator Gregg saying, you know, reconciliation, what's wrong with it? What's wrong with just being able to do things with 51
right.
votes? I tend to think Republicans have a pretty good case, though, that in when reconciliation has been used in the past, it's either been with legislation that the underlying legislation has strong bipartisan support, or it's been just, frankly, fiscal measures. And I like the 60-vote hurdle, especially when it comes to such a huge, sprawling piece of legislation. I think it should have to stand the test of having serious bipartisan support in order to get through. Because you're talking about, you know, remaking 1/6 or 1/7 or whatever it is of the economy. So that's not an unreasonable test to me. And I think Democrats know that they kind of have temporary, at least the size of their majorities in the House and Senate are temporary. They're inflamed by the timing of the election in November 2008. Couldn't have been better for them. And they know it's going away, and they got to pass this now, or they'll never have a chance again. It's not as though they know that this is legislation that's deeply popular, and they could run an election on it, not having passed it, and pick up seats, and actually defeat Republicans who are opposing it, and have larger majorities to pass it next time.
Well, I think here's where we're going to disagree about what this means for what this means going into the elections. I think that I respect your logic on why this particular piece of legislation should require a 60-vote hurdle and not a 51-vote hurdle. I disagree in large part because I think Republicans have shown there's not going to be bipartisan support for what is it at its heart actually a fairly popular bill with the American public. If, again, and you and I have talked about this before, but if you take the individual pieces of policy that are in that bill and poll on those, you find a much wider, much stronger bipartisan support among the American people than you do if you ask them about healthcare reform in general. So I think that actually we're not going to get Senate Republicans will not give, you know, strong bipartisan support to this bill. I mean, it's just not going to happen. The White House has tried again and again to incorporate various things, and the Republicans have just said no. And that is their right, because they, you know, that's what they want to run on. That's fine. I think when representatives go back to their districts, when representatives and senators go back to their districts, it's going to be much harder for them to explain why nothing happened than why something suboptimal happened.
Well, I would say a couple things. One, I think it's a bit of a fallacy that the individual pieces of this bill are much more popular than the bill itself. It's true of some of it. You know, that Newsweek poll, which I think has helped create this argument, it asked about...
There was a Newsweek poll, and there was a Kaiser Permanente poll that also found that most people don't know what's in the bill. When they polled on individual things like, you know, previous condition stuff, which I know is popular, but usually you can't logically support it, people said that that is something that they would want in the bill, and they would support it if it was in a bill, and then didn't know that it was already in the bill.
But if you had a poll that was just asking about the overall cost, that was asking about the various tax increases that are part of it, that was asking about the Medicare cuts, that was pointing out that millions of people are likely to lose their Medicare Advantage plans, to get bumped off their employer coverage, then it wouldn't be so popular. I mean, it's not a trick or an illusion that this bill is unpopular. It's just unpopular. I mean, we've been debating it for a year. So to me, it's... Democrats kind of buying into a delusion that once you pass an unpopular piece of legislation, it's magically going to become popular again, and or popular for the first time.
And there are going to be unpopular things that are going to have to get passed in it, because the things that are popular have, you know, there is a cost reaction to having the things that are in it that are popular. And I think that you know, Paul Ryan has actually done some really... he's clearly a new rising star on the Republican side. And also, I do respect, like, his plain talk about this stuff. The way that he pointed out that the COB estimates on this bill do, like, leave out some things. And this bill, this program will be more expensive than anyone wants to admit. But I also think that it actually is a force. It's a good thing to do. And it's something that Democrats had promised that they would do. I just think you can't run on health care, which Obama did, and everyone got on his coattails, and they ran on health care too, and then have nothing. Because, you know, if they don't do it now, we're never going to do it. It's going to go on the long list of failures to do any kind of meaningful health care reform.
Well, I just don't think the debate is going to go away or get any better for Democrats if they pass it. And it's just highly counterintuitive to think that actually passing something people don't want is you're going to get...
But it's not that they don't want the bill. They don't want some parts of it, which is true. Like, there's going to be some parts of all legislation that people don't like, right? I mean, if you pass, like, an entirely popular bill, that means you're not paying for something.
I don't know about that. I mean, you could pass a bill that was smaller than this, where you'd actually get some Republican votes, and it wouldn't be so radioactive. And it's just Democrats don't want to do that. And I think the reason they don't want to do it, in some way, is admirable. It's ideological, you know, and that's a dirty word in a lot of our political discourse, but it just means that you value certain things over other things, and you have a view about the way the world works. And Democrats, as you were pointing out a little bit earlier, think they're put on the earth to get universal coverage in healthcare. And so they should...
I believe I was put on the earth for other reasons, but, you know... perhaps you
politically.
I'm not sure if that's the case either. I don't see a lot of that behavior, at least in the Senate. In the House, I do think you have some very strong some people who believe very strongly and personally and morally that that's what they're supposed to do. Yes.
Well, I mean, that's Nancy Pelosi basically said it the other day. She's happy to take the hit, and some people have to fall on their swords to get this done. And I admire that sentiment on a certain level. I just don't think politically it's going to work out for them, one. And two, I oppose the underlying bill. So, I oppose every maneuver and way they're trying to get it through.
Now, do you think, we talked about this a little bit last week, but I'm curious if seeing the summit has changed your mind or informed you any further on how much of this failure to get this passed is Obama's fault?
I don't, we may have talked about this last time, I forget. I don't think it has anything to do with any tactical maneuverings one way or the other. I don't think
you think it's just the bill, the actual legislation.
I don't think it has to do with any communication problems. It's just too much. People don't want it. And Obama, you talked about Obama campaigning on health care, which is true in some sense, but he opposed the individual mandate. He opposed the Cadillac tax and actually viciously attacked John McCain over it and poured countless millions of dollars into negative ads on it. And he promised it would be a huge premium cut to everyone, this kind of painless thing that would cover more people, not inconvenience anyone in any way, and make everything cheaper. And that was just a total fantasy. He did not have a mandate for this bill in any sense whatsoever.
I agree that he did not campaign on the bill that is currently in the Senate. No one really did, except maybe John McCain, right? Actually, speaking of that, that was one of the high pieces of drama from the summit. How do you think McCain is looking these days?
Well, I think there are a couple things going on. One, obviously, he's feeling heat from the right in a primary, which is changing his behavior a little bit. Two, though, a lot of this stuff is just in his breadbasket. You know, his entire career, he's been a deficit hawk and scold. He hates big spending plans. He hates special interest deals in Washington. And, of course, that's what he talked about in the summit very characteristically. He didn't talk about policy because he doesn't really know it, which became clear during the campaign. But he really cares about these deals that he thinks bring shame on everyone who serves in Congress. And I thought Obama, it was pretty effective in slapping him down, and I would have liked to seen McCain come back at him, because I don't think Obama, he's just dismissed it, because I don't think there's any defending these deals. And McCain should have kept his teeth in Obama's ankle over it and demanded that he actually say something about the Cornhusker kickback and Louisiana Purchase and the special deal for Floridians down there where you are over Medicare Advantage. Because these are, I think ultimately it's the merits and the substance of the bill that are dragging it down, but the process has played a part in it as well, and that's why Republicans are shrewd to make a big stink over reconciliation as well.
I think that if they can make a big stink about it, that could be something helpful to them, but I also think that, you know, most people don't know what a filibuster is either. And when you are the minority party, it's hard to make the argument that it's not your fault that things aren't happening. Did I say that right? Things aren't happening. It is hard to say that it isn't your fault. Is that right? I've got way too many negatives in that sentence. I think it's just become clear. I'll say in the positive sense. I think it becomes clear that it's Republicans who are keeping things from happening, that Democrats are doing everything they can, and Republicans are a huge roadblock. And I think that looks bad. On the other hand, I think there's nothing as bad as actually just being an incumbent. So we'll see what happens. I love that we're talking about midterms already, and obviously we haven't even really seen a lot of these primary fights play out, except, speaking of Florida, I assume you've been paying close attention to the Rich Rubio race.
Oh, absolutely. Just one last point, though, on the Republican obstructionism on health care. When the bill's unpopular, there's no price to be paid for opposing it, and that's why they feel very comfortable in opposing it. Now, they want to seem reasonable, and that's why it was good for them at the summit that you had Lamar Alexander, kind of the headliner at the beginning, and folks like Ryan and Kyle who are very substantive on this and don't come across as ranters. But they're very comfortable opposing it as long as it's, underwater in some polls by almost as much as 2-1.
Right. Well, again, I guess we'll have to see how that turns out. But I want to talk about Rubio and Crist.
Let's talk about them. We had Rubio on our cover last fall, and it was something we did with a little bit of trepidation because we didn't know how real he was. He seemed like such an incredible long shot. But we did put him on the cover, and I think it was one of the factors that just helped him take off down there in Florida. And this is a race that I thought was going to be an upset, but now I'd almost be disappointed if Rubio doesn't crush Crist by 2-1. And Crist just has so many things going against him, not just the hug and his support for the stimulus, which is so unpopular among conservatives, but being a soulless incumbent is like the very worst thing. And I don't want to say he doesn't literally have a soul, but politically it's soulless, where he doesn't have a
being a rather crass incumbent, if you want to put it that way.
He doesn't have a true north in terms of political principal, and he's this you know, super tanned, stereotypical politician. And that's just not going to play well anywhere this year, especially in a Republican primary in a pretty conservative state.
I agree that it's not going to play well in the Republican primary, which is why there's all this talk about him possibly pulling out of the Republican primary and running as an independent, which does seem like it would give him more of a chance. I mean, he's not, unlike a lot of independent candidates, obviously he doesn't have to worry about name recognition, but then again, that in itself is kind of a problem. I think it's for certain that Rubio is going to win the Republican primary here. I mean, and also we have to keep in mind that's a pretty small primary with some pretty diehard Republican activists, you know, voting in it, and he's gotten a lot of national attention, which sometimes could backfire. But in this particular case, I actually think he's been very smart in the way he's portrayed himself. And he seems like young, fresh, energetic, that's supported by the Tea Partiers, but not himself someone who's too close to that movement, which is, I think, actually how most primary candidates are going to have to play that relationship if they want to succeed in the primary, succeed in the general. But I have to say that Chris seems like he's done a good job as governor. So it puzzles me that he wouldn't have a pretty strong shot if he ran as an independent.
Well, I think the problem with running independent at this point, it would play into the worst perceptions of him. Because, you know, if you start out as an independent and you're not a Republican or you're a Democrat and you come out of nowhere, that's one thing. But to be an incumbent governor from one party and then basically just quit and take your marbles home when it becomes clear you can't win your primary is just going to make you seem even more crassly ambitious than you seemed already. So who knows? I mean, there have been reports down there that from people close to him that he's seriously thinking about it. He's denying it up and down, of course, which is what he'll do until the day he announces he's an independent. But I have a hard time believing he would do that. He's going to try to tear, before he does that at least, he's going to try everything he can to tear Rubio down. I think he probably is the next senator from Florida. I'd give him very good odds. And I think there's a huge upside there for the Republican Party, because this is a guy who could immediately be a national star. He's young, he's Latino, he's vibrant, and there's just not that upside to Charlie Crist, who's totally uninspiring and a typical politician. So I'm rooting for Rubio just for ideological and political reasons.
Well, he's a better story, I'll say that too. As a reporter, I am enjoying covering this primary. And I would enjoy, I think I would enjoy covering Rubio as a senator. I think he has the potential to be more interesting, that's for sure. Although Crist has the potential to be more corrupt, which is always interesting.
Interesting in a different way.
Yeah. So we were going to move on from there. We're going to move on to New York politics.
New York's been very exciting.
Yeah.
We got Harold Ford out, Charlie Rangel on the ropes, and Governor Patterson presumably on his way out.
I hope so. I think this Patterson situation is just one of the most disgusting things I've seen play out. I guess New York basically counts as a national stage, considering, you know, its media market, if nothing else. The more we learn about this, the more, you know, sickened I am by that behavior, especially when you consider he did come in with domestic violence being part of his portfolio. This guy really should have known better.
And if I remember correctly, he actually was still talking about his domestic violence initiatives at the same time this whole thing was going on.
He was, and actually I think he did a lunch or something like that, like a women's a women's lunch, where he talked about this. And I have some friends that were sort of in his consultancy circle who said that they believed that this came as a shock to them too, in part because they believed he was sincere about feeling strongly about domestic violence. And other, you know, Democrats I talked to in New York, he's never, of all of the things that we could say bad about David Patterson, this is not the one that people thought was going to get him out of, you know, get him out of office. He has some questionable business dealings. He clearly has a personal life that he would prefer that we not find out about. And those are all the things that people were guessing was going to happen. I mean, what did you think was going to be the big shoe to drop, or what became referred to as the New York Times article, though I'm not even sure if this was the Times article that the Times was working on, you know, when people were talking about it.
I had no idea. I knew it would be ugly. You know, Patterson had one good day as governor when he first took over and gave his speech, and everyone was so glad that Spitzer was gone. And then the stories came out about Patterson and his girlfriends, and he's one of these guys that, oddly enough, he doesn't really seem interested in being governor.
No.
You know, the devastating New York Times report prior to this one was just about his schedule and how he conducts himself and how he goes missing and he can't hail the guy on the phone because he's not interested in working. But you have these politicians that aren't really interested in their jobs but still desperately want to keep them,
right.
You know, I guess out of prestige, if nothing else. So New York is just a cesspit politically,
yeah.
And it's very distressing because it's not just the corruption, it's the way that the state is run and the way it's going bankrupt. So you have what Sacramento has done to California, you have Albany doing to New York, and I would argue Washington now trying to do to the nation.
I do see the parallels, that's for sure. It is always interesting to me, like, how venal New York politics is. Again, I have some friends that sort of work around there. And it actually makes Washington look positively chummy, how bad things are. Even within parties in New York, there's various factions. And, in fact, we almost saw that with the Harold Ford potentially challenging Christian Gillibrand. And now it looks like there might be a Mort Zuckerman race.
Yeah.
Do you believe that? I have a really hard time believing that that's going to happen.
I have a hard time believing it, too. But if he could get the Republicans to swallow them, he'd have a very good chance. I mean, Gillibrand, what was the sliding bird reference? Parakeet? Is that what Harold Ford called her?
Oh,
I mean, it's just amazing the way she's being propped up by Chuck Schumer and the establishment. She gets the appointment from Governor Patterson, and they're just beating back every single primary challenge. And I think she's really ripe for the picking. And if it's my favorite candidate who's been brooded about is actually Dan Senor.
Oh, really?
Who was, you know, with the CPA and
oh, I know who he is.
Now with Fox News, and he's
Campbell
talked
Brown's,
about running.
Campbell Brown's husband.
And it's one of those weird races where there's a very winnable Senate race, but no one interested in running, and no one of any substance interested in running. So, Dan, if you're a Blogging Heads viewer, I'm just giving you a shout out and encouraging you to do it.
I can't wait to relitigate the Iraq War if he gets in. That would be awesome. That would be a fantastic way for the New York Senate seat to go. And I'm sure that'll be a winning issue for Republicans as well. That reminds me of, like, I actually was a little disappointed for that, because that didn't happen when it was talked about Andy Card running in Massachusetts, which actually, you know, we haven't talked since Scott Brown voted for the jobs bill, and the Tea Party turned on him immediately. Glenn Beck, you know, crossed him out of his slam book, whatever it is Glenn Beck does when he's upset with people. This is obviously not a surprise to anyone who's paying attention to newly elected Senator Brown's actual politics. But he was being paraded around with such great, you know, fever. Like, what do you think is going to happen to him?
Yeah, this is what I think a lot of conservatives kind of fooled themselves about Scott Brown, thinking he ran as the next Jesse Helms, which he just didn't, and that's not what he ever was. I mean, he's quite conservative in the Massachusetts context, but not in the national context, and it's clear that he wants to thrive as a Massachusetts Republican and win in 2012, which means he's not going to take down-the-line conservative votes. And just in the scale of values, I'd much rather have him voting for a $15 billion jobs bill that I think is a bad vote and is a waste of money, is not going to really help at all. It's basically a political thing. In Washington, you name something after what you want to create and pretend it'll actually create it. So if it's a jobs bill, it must create jobs, which is just nonsense. But in the scheme of things, I'd rather have him voting for that than going along with a $1 or $2 or $2.5 trillion, however you count, healthcare bill. And that's the really big thing, and he's going to be stalwart against that, and that makes it all worthwhile.
And he has the luxury of not really having to respond to his constituents on that level because of the Massachusetts healthcare problem, which healthcare situation, which whether you like it or not, it just is take it off the table for him in terms of a vote that he needs to be, like, really think deeply about. He can defend it either way, I think, personally.
What do you mean?
He could defend voting for it, and I think he could defend voting against it.
He couldn't defend voting for it, not after bragging about being the 41st vote.
Well, you'd be surprised. Again, this depends on how, I guess this depends on what all is going to happen over the summer and how the polling is going to pan out. I just have this faith that, like, people really want to see something happen. And maybe it will be something radically smaller. I actually, until the summit and until we started to hear some moderates saying that they would vote for reconciliation, go with reconciliation, I thought we were going to not have a bill. I thought that for sure we were going to end this year without any health care bill, and again, it would just go down in the long list. Not that long, four or five presidents that failed to get health care done. Now I do think we're going to get something. Do you?
You know, all along I've thought it's going to go down. I've said it's going to go down, so I'm going to stick with that. I think it's just, it's going to be hard to get the votes in the House. It was hard the first time around when the political environment wasn't as toxic as it is now. Now, on the other hand, you know, when your entire party and your president comes to you and says you're going to bring down the palace around our heads if you don't vote for this thing, it's very hard to resist. So there's a chance they'll get it. I still think they won't. And the window has been steadily closing for stepping back and doing something smaller.
Right.
You know, if he at the summit had said, okay, here's my plan B, which has been reported about, which I think would cover about half the number of people at a significantly lesser cost, if he had unveiled right then that bill, Republicans would have been really hard-pressed to oppose it, and he would have certainly peeled some of them off. But every day that goes by without going to that kind of plan B, it makes it more likely when he does go to the plan B, he'll be too late and he gets nothing.
But doesn't that speak to sort of, I mean, we're talking about Chris's crassness, which is fun to say fast, but if that's true, that speaks to a certain, you know, manipulation of the political system on the part of Republicans, because, I mean, wouldn't, no matter when he offered that second smaller package, isn't that still just as good a thing for Republicans to support?
Yeah, I mean,
so
in
like,
theory
so
too,
be,
but
isn't it bad that Republicans, for, you know, purely partisan purposes and not ideological purposes, would be against something in a month that they would be for now?
Yeah, I mean, but that's the way politics works. The political environment will be different. And I mean, the thing is, Republicans do, at least the balance of Republicans, it's not a question of, okay, it doesn't include this Republican idea or it does include this Republican idea. This is one thing the summit brought out. It's really a question of direction and fundamentals. So a plan that just goes half as far in the direction Obama wants to go is still going to be very bad for most Republicans, and most of them would oppose it no matter what. But then you have those gettable Republicans, you know, on the left fringe of the party, where for them the politics will matter a lot. And if it were 3 months ago and he'd come out with a scale plan, there'd be no question they would go for it. You know, right now if there's a scaled back plan, I think you'd have a good chance to get them. But if we're further down the road and there's been even more failure on this front and Democrats have invested even more capital and haven't gotten anything through, well, then their leverage just almost disappears, and I think doing anything begins to become sort of toxic, and people really want to move on. So it's just, you know, there's always a balance here, and right at the beginning, I thought they got it, they have to get something right, and I remember talking to a colleague in August, and we both agreed the only way they won't get anything is if they push it too big for too long, and I think they're really at the cusp of that point right now.
And I just want to reiterate, that makes me sad. I also think we're about out of time. I know you have some stuff to do, and
that
actually have
that makes me sad.
I have a review I need to get writing on.